I'm John Morgan.
And I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to this edition of Countercurrents Radio. This week, Greg is busy with other projects, so he's leaving it to Mike and I to do the podcast this week. And we're very honored to have with us Tatjana Festerling, who's a very well-known anti-immigration activist in Germany. She has been for many years. I imagine she's probably not too familiar to many English language listeners, so we're going to do our best to talk to her about her activities and how she got on this trajectory and her observations about the situation with immigration in Europe as a whole. So, Tatjana, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Just so people know a little bit about you, I know you were very involved prominently in Pegida until you ran into a problem with them during the migration crisis. And I know you were also one of the founders of the AfD in Hamburg. And I know you continue to be active. You're in Bulgaria now. Maybe I could just ask you, how did you first get started in politics? What was it that drew you into activism?
Actually, I was starting or getting interest in politics around 2012, 2013, and it started all with the founding of the party AfD, the Alternative of Germany. At that time, I was in India, and then I recognized that the media was covering a story about a new party with a lot of intellectuals, professors, and so on. And I thought by myself, finally, there is some intelligent resistance against this politics in Germany at that time. So when I came back to Germany, I joined the party and was very engaged and did a lot of things, even with the leadership of the party. I'm a friend with Frauke Petri, for example, till now. And then we founded the regional parts of the party in Germany. So, and I was busy with the party until the national election then in 2013. It was a hard job because the party was founded in February and the election was in September. So, and everybody was more or less unexperienced with this business of politics. So it was a very tough time in 2013.
So you actually left in 2013?
Yes, 2013, yes.
Mm-hmm. What is your opinion of what the party's been doing since then? I mean, they were quite successful in the recent election, comparatively. What's your opinion of their present activities?
You know, I think there is always two point of views. The one is from the outside, and a lot of things seem to be very successful. But I still have this view from inside. Although I'm not a member anymore, I know a lot of people in the party and I follow all their activities. And from inside, I have to say this party will fail. I'm convinced because this party is always dealing with itself. They never had a clear positioning. What is the core of this party? So they started as a Eurocritics party and an EU critic party. Right now, she's only identified because she is a anti-migration party and anti-Islam party. So I don't know. Some people even say the party was founded to collect all these conservatives, which Merkel has lost with her Christian Democratic Party.
That's interesting. Do you think it's possible that they could do anything positive in the coming years, or do you really despair that they'll be able to accomplish anything?
Of course, they accomplish a lot of things. For example, one thing is that finally in our parliament, in our Bundestag, finally there is something similar to a political debate again. This was almost dead before. Right now they have to, of course they have to debate, but this is not a rational debate what we see. For example, today they had this poll about the family reunion for migrants which have only some temporary permission to stay in the country. And this was only emotional. It was from the beginning on, it was just an emotional discussion. There is no reasoning, there's no arguing, and this is somehow a mirror for our whole German society, maybe even the Western European society, what is going on in this parliament and also what is going on in this party, because we see quarrel and battles about might, and we see only a lot of self-destruction, and the party is more or less dealing with itself. And of course, we talk about Germany, we talk about the most important country in Europe concerning the migrant crisis. And of course, this party is infiltrated like all these other street movements and resistance movements. And so, of course, they have their people. I don't want to call them agents, but at least there are agents. They have these people in the party, and these people always approach when the AfD, the party, gets some success or is doing something properly. Then somebody of these people shows up and gives a speech which is full of Nazi terms and associations and so on. So it's really a mess. I don't believe in any political solution anymore. And also the AfD, it is some kind of nice Byzantinic chatter. And yes, now you hear some more intelligent words, but there is no real radical change, political change, even inside. I don't believe in this.
Well, it sounds like from what you're saying that you actually think it's being subverted from within.
Yes.
You have people trying to sabotage it.
Yeah, of course.
Frauke Petry very visibly left the party just after AfD's electoral victory.
Yes.
And it wasn't clear to me why she did that. Do you have anything to say about her motivation?
Yes, of course. My opinion is against the opinion of a lot of people in the AfD. But I think that Frauke, she is a very honest and decent person. And she is courageous, and she's also very intelligent. And she was one of the founders of the AfD. And she always asked her own party to position itself, to find some proposition which is a means to identify with the party in order to prevent that these really right extremists or strange people showing up and starting destroying the party and pushing the party more and more to the right wing, to the right extremist wing. So that media, other politicians, and so on can start their battle against the AfD. So she was a realistic politician in my point of view. I trust her, and she tried everything. At the end, she was more or less isolated in the party, but she was the most successful politician in the last election. So also the people, the voters, trusted her, and she helped to bring the AfD into our parliament. And after that, she said, okay, I cannot stand this anymore. I don't want to be trapped in a party with people with opinions I don't share. And so she is, in my opinion, it's a very consequent step of her. And right now she was founding some kind of a new party, which is a Kader party in German. We say an elite party where you have to be very careful who can be your member and who is able to get into higher functions in the party, because this was the biggest mistake of the AfD in the beginning, because they took everybody who wanted to be in an alternative party. And so you have a lot of not so intellectual and not so intelligent people in high function positions now. So in my opinion, her behavior and her step is absolutely logical, and it is courageous, because she couldn't succeed in the AfD anymore.
It seems like this is a problem that occurs commonly within right-wing movements, that they start at the grassroots level, but yeah, then they can't make the transition to actually become, you know, a regular party that large numbers of quote unquote normal people want to get involved with.
Yes. Yeah, they are always looking on the amount of members, the numbers, the money the members bringing, of course, and the power, but they always forget that you have to deal with basic democracy. And this is something which doesn't work out in these times anymore.
Well, you mentioned before that you thought that the problems of the AfD reflected the problems in Germany and Western Europe as a whole. And what is it that you see as particular problems that have led Europe to this, you know, Western Europe in particular, to this, I guess we could call it precipice, demographically speaking?
In my opinion, we need to look on the situation with our psychological glasses. We all are doing the mistake, the intellectuals on the one side and even the people on the streets with their rallies and demonstrations and so on. We still think that everything what is happening around follows rational and logic rules. But this is not true anymore. There is no rationality to be seen. Also in the States, in the morning I saw an interview with Tucker Carlson with a strange lady who claimed that even yoga now is racist. This is just only funny. But there is no, absolutely no rationality, no logic to be seen. But we continue to argue and to try to find a debate or something. But you cannot debate with highly neurotic people, especially the Germans, but more or less all these Western European countries. They are really completely insane societies, highly neurotic societies. We see a high narcissism in the societies, as well as we see codependency. And if you have experience with some kind of a psychopath, then you know that you cannot discuss on a rational level with these people. And we see this in small conversations, in dialogues, we see it in groups, in organizations, and we see it, of course, in the whole society right now. And so this is why I am also convinced that all this politics, all this chatter, all these writings, all our words, they won't bring us to a solution. We analyze and analyze and analyze since years, but where are we now? It's even getting worse and worse from day to day. So in my opinion, we are really making the mistake that we still think we can solve the problems with our words. It's the European way, of course, but in my opinion, we are trapped in this European way of thinking and arguing and so on, because we have our inner enemies. I spoke about narcissism, but now we have this big threat from outside. We have this big threat of Islamization. And if you look at this whole Ummah, in my opinion, this whole Ummah is completely neurotic. These are not sane people. They are traumatized and they are highly narcissistic too. So it's typical for a narcissist that he's not even able to criticize himself or to be criticized or so. And this is the reason why we see all these unbelievable things in the world right now.
Yes, I understand your point that both sides are neurotic and narcissistic. The problem is that with the migrants, they're not just using words, they're extremely proactive to get what they want.
Exactly. And this is what I also say. It's we have different means. It's not an equal battle. It's not an equal war. We fight with our Byzantinic chatter, and they are coming with their machetes and their knives and their explosives and of course with their birth jihad. So this is why I absolutely, if I look into the future, for me, Western Europe is already lost. It's completely lost. There is nothing to change. We have these enemies from within. We have this completely insane society. The people are completely afraid. You have to imagine, this is ridiculous. The people are even more afraid of words and thoughts. The people in Germany, my countrymen, they are so afraid of being called a racist or a Nazi or whatever bullshit they call them. So this fear of these words or of these bad thoughts is even bigger than the very real fear that their daughter is going to school and is being raped on her way to school. This fear is even bigger. And this is also the reason why I'm almost desperate right now, because I ask the people always, be self-responsible. This is the key to everything, self-responsibility. And of course, there are means. We can stop everything. If everyone is uniting and doing civil disobedience, and there is a lot to do. The left showed us in the past, but these so-called patriots, conservatives, or whatever, they are always trapped in decency, no, and in their fears, and so on. So I'm not convinced that this will find a good end.
Well, you talk about civil disobedience. Do
yes.
you see that that's something that can be organized in Europe? I mean, this is something I always see in America, is that people, they always want to put their trust in a leader or a political party. Before Trump, people on the anti-immigration right, we could say, they were always kind of despairing and said, we have to work outside the system. But as soon as Trump came along, they put all their hopes in
yes.
him and in the Republican Party. And the fact is that, as we've seen, I mean, at best, he's only going to be able to achieve modest success, if even that. So people keep waiting for somebody to come along and do the work, whereas it's really the people who need to be proactive here. But I don't see much sign of that in the
yeah,
U.S.
Me too.
Do you think that could happen in Germany or Western Europe?
No, I don't think so. Although we have seen, for example, there was, I guess it was 2 years ago or something, there was a strike of the people from between France and UK. I think the ferrymen had a strike because they were so much attacked by the migrants. And then they just stopped working. And then we saw a queue of trucks. I think it was more than 100 kilometers long, this queue of trucks. And nothing worked. Nothing. It was a strike. And people saw this. And then, of course, they started to build even higher fences and they put extra police to Calais and so on and so. So there was somehow a reaction on this. And there are some other examples. Of course, our left, they use this means of civil disobedience all the time. But I don't believe that, because civil disobedience, then if you are getting, and you can, for example, in Germany, you can go to the doctor and say, okay, I have such a terrible headache today, I cannot go to work. 2 days later you go, and now I have a terrible stomach or a depression or whatever. You can go to your doctor and say, I cannot work anymore, and you stay at home. And this is not even dangerous. Nobody can look into your head, or nobody can say, okay, you are a pretender. You just tell me you're ill. You are completely sane. Nobody can force you to go to work. This is a kind of resistance, which I call passive aggressiveness. And everybody who is a mother or father knows this from your children. You cannot force your child to listen to the teacher at school, for example. This is not possible. If the child says, no, I want to watch out the window, then you are helpless, more or less. And this is so obvious, and this is so easy, and that it's also not dangerous for the individual. But people are too afraid. They are, as you said, they are always longing to the Führer, to the leader. And it's maybe not only they connect, of course, they connect with the leader. They connect their illusions. And it's I see one illusion, the next illusion pops up. Then there is another bubble with the illusion. And the people are sticking to their illusions in order to avoid to become self-responsible. For me, this is one of the core explanations why we see this mess right now in Europe.
Do you see any hope in any of the other, you know, let's say like non-political party groups like the Identitarians? Do you see anything positive happening there?
To be honest, I am not so convinced about them because, of course, last year in the summer there was a big Identitarian show on the middle on the Mediterranean Sea. They chartered this ship and there was a loud noise and T-shirts, branding, merchandise.
Defend Europe, they were calling it.
Yeah, yeah, Defend Europe. So there was a whole merchandising machine going on, and they asked for money, 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 be pleased, donations, donations, donations. But what did they achieve? What do they want politically? I don't know. Till now, even if I talked to Martin Zellner, for example, this Austrian leader of the Identitarian there, of course he's brilliant, he's intelligent, he read a lot of books, and he's a lot of talking about identity and so on and so on. But what is the political goal? What do they want to achieve? For me, this is also some other kind of illusion, some other kind of chatter. And I asked him once, when we met at a conference, and I asked him openly, in public, Martin, what should people do, in your opinion, according to you, who cannot join some spectacular climbing on the Brandenburg Gate or something? What would you recommend? What could these people do? And then he said, okay, donations for us so that we can do. And the second is join the mass demonstration, the mass rallies. But which mass rallies? There is no mass rally in Germany. It's all destroyed also from within, from Pegida. There is no mass demonstration. If this is the only conclusion and the only recommendation, I'm sorry, this is poor.
Yeah, I've heard that criticism of the Identitarians from other quarters too, that it's not specific enough in their goals and so forth. But you just mentioned Pegida. What was your experience with them? Did you have a positive impression of them, or do you think this is also just some chatter, as you put it?
Pegida is a different story. I'm looking back right now. I was a part of Pegida, of course. I was more than 1 year. But if I look back, I think Pegida was founded. I believe that this Bachmann is somebody from the state. He is criminal. He has the ugliest character I ever met in my life. He's lying. He's drug addicted and so on. So he is very good to blackmail. And for me, if I look back, in Germany, the resistance on the street started with the hooligans. And I have a big sympathy for hooligans, because these are the only men in Germany who are able and willing to go in some physical fight. And we had in 2014, in October, end of October, there was a huge rally in Cologne. And this rally was being organized via Facebook and so on. And I recognized it in July or August or something. And then I saw huge numbers of people who said, yes, we will show up. And then Facebook deleted this page. They found a new page. Next page was deleted. So this game of deleting and trying to shut down somebody or some organization already started there. And then I thought, okay, if the state is so furious about these hooligans, if they meet, and the hooligans, as you know, they have their own, they have their football clubs, and normally they are enemies against each other. But if the hooligans start to unite against Salafists, then this is something really, really good. And this should be somehow a blueprint for all these other interest groups finally to reunite. So I decided to go there. And as we now know, there was one, as we call it in Germany, V-Mann, one state agent, was already in this organizational team of this Hogesa demonstration. But this guy, he couldn't stop the demonstration. He just gave information to police, to our secret service and so on. And so the politicians were prepared. And when this demonstration with about more than 6,000 hooligans in Cologne started, they had this official version of what was going on and violence and whatever. And so, and I was the witness there because I was there and I wrote on Facebook a small article and I published it in the evening. And next day it was shared, I think it was finally 250,000 times, because this was the only voice of an eyewitness which was completely against the official version of what was going on in Cologne. And of course, they had to destroy this resistance. And in my opinion, the hooligan resistance was true. This was a real. This was honest. This was not infiltrated. And Pegida, in my opinion, is the reaction of the state to this hooligan demonstration, because Pegida is controllable, because Bachmann is at the top and, of course, the people around. And it is like a somehow like a ventile. And when I joined Pegida, at that time, I didn't have this thoughts I told you now, but I only saw this huge crowd of people on the square, and I have never been close to Lutz Bachmann. As I said, he's a terrible character, and he's not very smart as well. But this huge mass of people, and then Dresden, the former GDR, and the memory of this, yes, we had one revolution, a peaceful revolution, and we will start our second revolution, and so on. So this was my, at that time, I felt it as a duty, to give my speeches at Pegida, and also this mayor candidate, this mayor election in Dresden, this was the last chance, in my opinion. But I also experienced that, for example, Bachmann never wanted to develop a Pegida. He never was interested in some kind of strategy, some kinds of, goals or, action plans or visions and so on. No, he is a party event, a creator. And besides that, Pegida is a money machine, because they always have these boxes on the square. And I was a witness several times when they opened the boxes. It was full of money. So I guess Bachmann now, he got almost at least 2 million euro in cash, without taxes, without anything. So he is a Pegida millionaire. And nobody is asking about this money. No tax authority, no state, nobody. So this maybe is his salary for destroying the resistance movements in Germany.
So you really think Pegida is controlled opposition?
Yes, absolutely.
What you said about hooliganism, I thought was interesting, that you thought that they were the only ones really, you know, prepared to take to the streets and actually do something. But I think that's always the problem there, is that that kind of solution, you know, that sort of, you know, challenging people in the streets, inevitably in Western society, the state will always intervene to stop that. Right. Do you think there's any way around that?
Of course they stop it. Of course, because the rules are they're dangerous for our state. If you go, for example, I was when I was last time in Germany, I was in the stadium at the football soccer game, Dynamo Dresden, for example, and there was the stadium was full of people, full of men, and especially in Dresden, they had once in another German city, they were even wearing uniform. They had uniform. They had camouflage t-shirts, camouflage hats. They had their faces of with the this soldier makeup something, and they had they were there for a soccer game, and 3,000 of these camouflage, not hooligans, but football fans showed up in this city. And there was a march, there was drumsticks and so on, and they had fire and smoke and everything. And this was, I have to say, this was so sexy. This was so attractive. Yeah, it was for also for other football people. And suddenly everybody said, have you seen this? The Dynamo Dresden guys, what they did and so on. So that the state and also our football authorities, this board of German Federal Football Board, they at once, they punished them. They had to pay a huge fee. Even on YouTube, you don't find, or it's very hard to find, pictures of this hooligan visit in Karlsruhe, of this Dynamo Dresden fan visit in Karlsruhe, because it was so attractive, and they were fearing that this could create some kind of epidemic effect, that this could create some ideas for other football clubs and for the football fans, not only hooligans, but also for these normal real men. So they shut down everything around this, and this club is till now, it's under special surveillance. So yeah, this is, of course, this is a danger, of course.
It's the same story, of course, in the U.S. too, if there's any type of street action is attempted. You know, the state will always allow a certain amount of it to let people blow off steam, and then they intervene and stop it and start to punish the people involved.
Yeah, yes.
Tatiana, I saw that you ran for the mayor of Dresden. Was that under one of the existing German political parties, or did Pegida have its own party, and what was the result?
No, I wasn't a member of any party, and also Pegida is no party. But if you ran for this mayor in Dresden, it was also possible to run as a complete independent and free candidate. And of course, I was the keynote speaker at Pegida at that time, and the people and me, we loved each other. So it was in Germany, you need some signatures, a certain amount. It was 240 signatures in the town hall. People had to go there giving their signature to support one of these candidates. And at last, it was, in my case, it was more than 1,000 signatures. So the support of the people was huge. It has never been this in history before, that the support was so big. Of course, this was the reason why I decided myself to go for this election and to be a candidate, although this never was in my career plans before. But I thought this is maybe the last chance that people can elect a direct representative of the people, without party, without connections, without these networks, without these dependency on somebody or some money or something, just free. And we started without any money. We had no infrastructure. We had nothing, but we had the people. We had our monthly rallies. And this was my, of course, this was my election and campaigning rallies. And people donated, and people helped. For example, we distributed leaflets and flyers, I think almost a 250,000 of them. And the people came to our rallies. We gave them packages with these leaflets, and then they went in the night or in the evening and put them into the post boxes and every household, everything. And it was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. And this, I also did it because it was finally some kind of political goal. There was an election, and this was really a smart goal. You could measure it. There was a finish line. And right. Yeah, and there was something real and concrete and, of course, highly political. And I think also the result was that in only 4 weeks of campaigning, it was at 9.7%, which meant it was almost 22,000 people in Dresden gave me their vote. So
how many other candidates were in the race?
We have been six, if I remember. We had, of course, the biggest parties. And there was one candidate also, a socialist candidate, and she was supported from the by our Green Party, by our far left party, from the Social Democrats. So we had been altogether six people. And what was really a shame was that the AfD at that time had also their own candidate, which was an old man without charisma, without a vision, without, I don't know, some spirit, and he took 4.8% or something. If we could, we would have combined this. If he would withdraw at that time, and people, also these AfD people, would have voted for me, then it would have been the same level like the Minister of Internal Affairs in Saxony from Merkel's party. So it was not so. It was a huge result, because all polls in Germany from all our big media and newspaper, the Spiegel, he saw me at 1 to 2% of the votes, and they were really afraid when they saw it was almost 10%.
As an independent, especially.
Is independent, without network, without dependency, absolutely out of control. And with somebody, of course, they knew already because of my speeches that I'm not afraid of anybody. So, of course, this was a danger. And a lot of people thought that after I withdraw, I didn't went to the second round of this election. And after this election was closed, they started to flood in migrants to Dresden also. Because if they would have done it before, maybe even more people would have voted for me. And then Merkel would have had a problem, because then... If this, it's just an idea, it's just an illusion, but if I would have been mayor of Dresden, then this city, this big city, would have been the first city who said no, no migrants. And this would have been a problem for Merkel and for all these migrant politicians.
So were most of your supporters from AfD, or if they were, you know, the CDU, CSU? Or if they might even have been more leftist parties, just because you were running as an independent and offered this, you know, had this charisma. I'd be curious to know, if you analyzed, which parties your support base came from.
I think there was no such a precise analyze about the votes, but what I heard is that a lot of people from the CDU have voted for me, as well as the AfD, of course, but also I heard also from some social democrats that they voted for me, because they there are still some social democrats who are who are absolutely not agreeing with this politics of Martin Schulz and his people. And the social democrats on the national level. So it was a mix, but definitely no leftists and no greens. But it was very funny, because in one of these speeches I said, you know what, leftists, look at me. I'm the only one who is not connected with globalists or with Soros or with all these other people. I'm not establishment. I am the anti-establishment. I'm the only one who is representing the anti-establishment. And you leftists, you are sitting on these discussion rounds with your candidate, and you're welcome into establishment. And this was, of course, this was a funny situation because normally the hardcore leftists, this is their image and this is their normal, their core identity to be anti-establishment. So this was really a funny situation at that time.
That's the funny thing about leftists today.
Yeah.
They think of themselves as being anti-establishment, but they embody the establishment in the West today, in the U.S. also.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they are fighting for Soros and they are fighting for globalism and so on. But by the way, this is an interesting point in my, they are fighting, on the one hand with Occupy and so on. They were fighting, globalists. And, on the other hand, they are supporting them. And, this is absolutely, this contradiction. I think this is one of the problems we also have. We cannot understand. Everything is contradicted these days. So this is also a reason why we don't see any logic. And how do you want to argue with somebody who is completely contradictional?
Well, a lot of things in politics these days just aren't what they seem, I guess we could say. They appear to be one thing but actually are something else. So
yeah, of course.
That's happening everywhere, I think.
Yeah, but this also depends with our language, because we are using terms and connecting concepts, for example, democracy or equality or some things. We still connect with this term something good and something progressive, but in a good sense. So we still have concepts in our minds about these terms that they are using, but they are using them already in another context. This reframing technique we see all the time. So this is why we all have problems to express ourselves. We need new words. And so this is also one of my points. We need to, what the left is doing since years and years, this is, as I know, an idea of Saul Alinsky, to reframe terms, certain terms. And this is something the conservatives never did. We still stick to these terms. And for example, one of if I have to argue with so-called patriots, I always say, tell me exactly what the definition of fighting. What is this? Because I always hear we have to fight. So what is fighting? And then there is the big stillness rising up. So, and in my opinion, we still have this idea and this concept of fighting, of something aggressive, something which is very confrontative, which is full of energy, and which is going, pushing, and so on, and even pictures of soldiers and weapons and so on. But I think we spoke already about passive aggressiveness. This is a bias. We have to define also terms like fight. We have to speak about the fight 2.0. And fighting, in my opinion, means passive aggressiveness. This means withdrawing and being not confrontative, but taking this, what our governments, our state, urgently needs, our willingness to perform, our decency, and of course our taxes. So this is something I think we have to redefine certain important terms.
Yeah, basically what I think you're saying is that we have to adopt some of the strategies that the left used to get to where they are. And I think that is something that conservatives really struggle with. Like, you know, I know of a few right-wing intellectuals who are talking about these things, but it hasn't really spread out yet into the wider right-wing movement, I would say. And that's a real problem. We don't control language. The left does.
Of course, yes, of course. And of course, it's also a question of being courageous and saying, okay, you call me a Nazi, I don't care. Call me Nazi, call me, I don't know, kitchen plate, or call me television or whatever, I don't care. Call me whatever you like. It's your label you are putting on me. It's your label. It's your thoughts. It's your problem, honey. So, and this is something, the people are so indoctrinated, and the people are so manipulated, and the people are so full of fear. It's unbelievable. Especially if I look at my own country, or my own people, the German people, then I ask myself, you know, we have so many resources. We were the people of the thinkers and the poets. We are engineers. We are always busy. We are always working. We are always pushing and so on. So then I ask myself, what the hell are we afraid of? We can do this wherever in the world. The German, this quality, this special quality, or efficiency, for example. So what are the people afraid of?
Don't you think it's just conditioning left over from the reaction after the Second World War, where, you know, sort of everything nationalistic or right-wing was kind of looked down on and regarded with suspicion? Don't you think it comes from that, or do you think it's deeper?
No, I think it's even deeper. This is too simple, explanation, to say this is the famous guilt of the Second World War and so on. No, this is, of course, we are conditioned. Every evening you find some Hitler stuff in television or in a newspaper or it's still, till now, this guilt has always to be revitalized or refreshed and so on. But this is not the only guilt. They invented a lot of other ideologies, like climate change, like gender, like feminism now and so on. So that these ideologies are only to bring people into guilt. You have to feel guilty if you use your car to go to the next gas station to buy some cigarettes. Then you are double guilt, because you're smoking and you use your car. And you are guilty in Germany if you don't separate your garbage. You are guilty if you make some funny jokes about, I don't know, women or something. You are so guilty. So this is the guilt. The guilt is the best weapon and the best means to manipulate the people. And this is what we see. We see all over these guilty people. And instead of the people say, okay, I was not born in the Second World War, I have nothing to do with this, and leave me alone with this, I'm over it. And if I'm walking through my life with all this guilt, then I'm not even able to make a responsible decision, because my mindset, my personal mindset, is so infected with all this guilt that I'm not even able to make a free decision. And this is what we see, this collectivism, this mindset, this personal mindset, this individual mindset, but also the mindset of the whole society. And this is, I come again to my starting point. This is a psychological question. We have to start to analyze it under psychological aspects. And of course, also, if there is something like a solution, we also have to find it in this psychological area.
Well, it seems like Austrians are much less affected by guilt. Why do you think that is? And do you see the possibility, perhaps, of the Austrian mindset spilling over into Germany?
No. Yeah, this is interesting. In Austria, you have this Burschenschaften, for example, and you have a lot more of these traditions. They kept their traditions. In Germany, everything was destroyed. That's true. But no, I don't think. I hoped also of the French people that maybe there is, because they are, I thought they are the revolutionaries, and maybe they can create this infection, or they can create some kind of epidemic effect or something. But no, I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe hopefully they, the Austrians now will get closer and closer to Orban, because right now I see Hungary very isolated.
That's true. Well, they're at least getting some help from the other Visegrad countries, like Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia. But yeah, within the EU, they certainly have no friends in the West.
Yeah, of course. But if I'm not so convinced, because also in Poland there are going some strange things going on. Half of the government was exchanged. And now I always forgot his name, this new prime minister. He's very EU-friendly and so on. So I don't know. Right now, very interesting here in Bulgaria. we have two things very interesting. There's still a ratification of this Istanbul Convention, which is, they call it a resolution or some kind of European law against violence against women. But this is, of course, this is just the surface. It's about the third gender and all this gender and sexualizing our children in schools and kindergartens and so on. Of course, transgender stuff and marriage for all, same sex marriage is behind that. And the first time in the history of Bulgaria, the very powerful patriarch of the Orthodox Church stood up against the government. And he even threatened the prime minister here that he will throw him out of the church if this ratification is going through the parliament. And this is really very interesting, because he has a big influence on the people here. The people are absolutely standing behind the patriarch. Then he also got the Catholics. The Holy Synod also signed a paper, and is, he united the religious leaders, also the Grand Mufti here, who is the leader of the Bulgarian Muslims. So these three big religious leaders stood up against the government. Then several parties, and interestingly, also the Socialist Party of Bulgaria, stood up against the ratification. More than 30 movements wrote an open letter, and now they postpone it. So it's now it's not anymore on the list, ratification of this Istanbul Convention in Bulgaria won't happen next years. And the same as the fracking. People rose up and stand up against the fracking plans of the government, and even these plans are right now completely buried under the table. So these are two wins, and on the other hand, they 2 weeks ago they took more than 150 people from our groups, from Vasilevsky Military Veterans Union and sympathizers, into jail. And they has had to stay there for more than 1 week. Then they were released because of an unallowed possession of weapons or something. So this is stupid, of course, but it starts that these, I don't know, these kind of destabilization and these games with your opposition. So it will be very interesting to watch what is going on in Bulgaria and also in Romania this spring and summer, because they need this Balkan route. And the first approach is that Bulgaria and Romania should join the Schengen area, and then the floodgates are open. then the floodgates are really open. And I don't know whether Orban's fence can protect the rest. I don't know.
That's a good question. And I've heard that could happen as soon as this year or by next year at the latest, you know, Romania entering Schengen. So that'll be, at least what you said about Bulgaria was promising after, you know, we kind of offered our listeners a pretty bleak vision of Western Europe. But if we go back a little bit, I think we both would agree that there's more hope, at least, even though there's great challenges there as well in Eastern Europe. And in fact, we both met in October. We took a look at the border fence in Asotalom in Hungary along the Serbian border, which played a very significant role in, at least putting a stop to the Hungarian part of the migrant crisis that's still going on. And you were, in fact, when we met, you were on your way to Bulgaria at the time. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what drew you there and what sort of activities you've been doing there.
I'm a member of the Vasilevsky Military Veterans Union and also the BNO Shipka, which is a national movement here. And with thousands of members here. And the Vasilevsky guys, they're protecting the green border in Bulgaria, because everyone is, also the government, of course, is telling in Brussels, oh, we have this wonderful border fence and so on, but this is ridiculous and this is a lie. This Bulgarian border fence is only, I don't know, 100 kilometers, if it is 100 or less. And it is built not the Hungarian way, but very. It's not solid. It has no fundaments. So, at some parts it was falling down and so on. So the border protection and Bulgaria, the Bulgarian Turkish border is the EU outline border, is de facto not there. So. The border is not protected. I myself was in October. I was with people from Le Figaro magazine at the border, and I was on Turkish territory because at the green border and these small gypsy villages, you have fences like cow fences, cattle fences, but this is not a border protection. But very interesting is that all these borders there, you can see this old infrastructure from the Cold War, from the communism times. So the infrastructure is there. The people are still living who know how to secure a border, but it is not done. So you see, there is no will to secure this border, like, for example, Orban does. And people from here, mostly former soldiers and foreign legion and policemen and so on, they founded this military veterans union. And right now, a lot of young Bulgarians joining them, and they are always, even now, even in the winter, they're in the border region and patrolling there. And of course, they catched migrants in 2016, a lot of them, big groups of migrants. And if they catch them, they bring them back to the border police and they put them back to Turkey.
So these people are just private citizens who take their own time and put themselves at risk to do this.
Yes, yes. This is this is a completely different to the Western mindset. These people, and I told with them, I try to get very often to meet these people. And whenever I, whomever I ask, I said, why are you doing this? And then the young guy or the old guy or whoever, they look at me with big eyes and say, what? But this is natural. This is, I'm just doing what my ancestors did. And this makes also a difference. The Bulgarians have been conquered. And this is not so far away in their history. So they know what it means to be conquered by Islam. And then they experience communism. So the Bulgarians maybe are more sensitive about loss of freedom, and they are more willing to fight for this freedom. So this defense will is to be seen here among the young people. And of course, it's absolutely voluntary. They won't get money. And some of them are really so, because Bulgaria is not a rich country, some of them are so poor and they have small children. They leave their family at home on the weekend and they cannot even afford the benzene, the gasoline for to come in the forest. So this is all dependent on donations, or at least there are more or less two or three people who are financing all of this.
That's really fantastic. Can they accept donations from foreigners? If there is a way, yeah, we should put a link to that in the when we post this podcast.
Yeah, that
you should send me the information.
That would be nice. Yes. They're really, they need money for almost everything. They need uniforms. They need, these very basic things. And of course, they also have to, like myself also, I have a lot of criminal charges and sentences against me. And also these people have this. And then you have to go to Sofia to the law court. Then you have to go to another city to the law court. And this is always, it costs time, it costs money. And they try, all over, they try to put this pressure on people. And but these are brave people, brave men, even some women are there. And of course, there are sometimes there are state enemies, and sometimes, but for the Bulgarian people, they are heroes. And there's a big, big sympathy, among the Bulgarian, population for these people, for these men.
That's really amazing when you think about the fact that these are sort of the forgotten, or maybe more accurately, the countries that people look down on in the West and
yes.
in the U.S. as well are the ones who are actually defending Europe with their own resources.
Yes.
I mean, in America, you know, people would always expect, you know, it would be great that if somebody else takes care of the problem, but you know, I'm not going to get involved. You know, it's my tax dollars should solve that. So that's great that, people are so motivated to, I mean, because what they're doing isn't just, of course, protecting Bulgaria, it's protecting all of Europe.
Yes, of course.
So.
Of course.
People who don't even care about them are benefiting from this.
Yeah, and of course. And we always talked about this. On the other hand, in Bulgaria, the refugees or these migrants, these so-called refugees, nobody wants to stay, because here you are not treated well. You are not provided with house, car, food, money, and so on. So on the other hand, Bulgaria, the men could also say, okay, we switch to become human trafficker. This is a much, much, much better business. We help all these migrants to come through Bulgaria. We deliver them to the Serbian border or wherever, and then have fun with them. But these men are going to the Turkish border. And by the way, last year in October, it was a nice coincidence. I was with these guys from Le Figaro magazine, and I published these pictures on Facebook of this complete open border between Bulgaria and Turkey. And I also published some pictures about the EU projects, come get closer, so Bulgaria and Turkey should get closer, and projects without borders and so on. So they pumped the EU. In 2000, the project was released on 2011, and the money flow was in 2012. So it was absolutely same time when the Arabic Spring started. So they gave into these small gypsy villages along the border. They pushed in EU money. It was almost, this one village, it was 120,000 something, or 150,000, which is a huge amount for such a small gypsy village. And I looked around And I say, where is the money? I don't see any new building. I don't see any infrastructure. I don't see nothing. Where's the building? So they use this money to pay the mayors and clan leaders or these people who are in charge in these villages in order to keep the border open, in order to keep quiet and to keep shut up and so on, to keep their mouth shut. So this is something new, what we discovered when we were at this border region. And when I published these pictures of this wide open border, and there was a journalist in Bulgaria, some days later, she also released her own pictures about the fence, falling down fence, and migrants climbing over some fences and so on. So she had a lot of pictures. And several days later, the government of Bulgaria came together and they made an instant law that you are now, it's forbidden to come close to the green border. And they never defined what is the border. Is it the Turkish border? Is it the Greek border? Which border do you mean? No precise definition. As well as what does it mean to come close? Is it 5 meters? Is it 50 meters? Is it 100 meters? Or is it 5 kilometers? So they are completely unprecise. So everyone is now charged with a fee of 1,000 leva, which is 500 euro, if you are caught in this border region.
Wow. That's that's quite something.
Yes, but nobody's talking about this. So the border, the outline border of EU, it's nobody's interested in. And of course, in spring we expect migrant routes, a new migrant route via the Black Sea. They started in autumn already to Romania, but we are expecting as soon as the sea will be more calm in the spring, we expect a migrant from Turkey to Romania. But also the Romanian guys start to prepare, and even the Romanian border police is very strict. They even shot against some of these rubber boats in autumn.
I have to say, though, I mean, as good intentioned as these volunteers are in Bulgaria, they probably aren't going to be able to stop everybody. They don't have the resources for it, I would suspect.
No, because if you have seen this unprotected outline border of the EU, you know, right now the real, and this is what Vladimir Rusev says. He's the boss of the Vasilevsky Military Veterans Union. He said, you already have thousands of ISIS jihadists in the Western Europe. They already are in. And these who want to come, they come by car, they come by plane, and they come by boat or something. They are not anymore in these migrant groups anymore. They have other ways to come into the EU.
So really, it's not a question of just one country standing up. Unless the EU addresses it, it's going to continue.
Yes, in my opinion, it's and of course the eastern countries, the eastern nations have to protect themselves. And as I already said in a Polish interview, I'm convinced you have to have these eastern nations have to rebuild the Iron Curtain. They have to protect from the West right now, because the West is already, it's completely full, more or less. So the Eastern European countries have to protect themselves from the West. They have to rebuild the Iron Curtain as soon as possible. And of course, to Turkey, and yeah, of course.
I agree with you, but you know as well as I do, I mean, at least for the Eastern European countries that are in the EU will never tolerate that. That's the problem. I mean, they're already giving Hungary such grief over, you know, the measures that they've taken. You know, I mean, they keep threatening them with expulsion and so forth.
Yeah, but there is also maybe a bigger group, not only the Visegrad nations, but there is this so-called 3C initiative, which is from the Baltics to the Black Sea and to the Mediterranean Sea. If these countries would somehow unite, then they could build somehow a counter EU. Somehow an Eastern EU concept. And of course, only Hungary or only Bulgaria also, this doesn't work out. So they have to unite. And of course they're already announced that they want to throw out these countries who don't want to take migrants. So EU will be destroyed. This is no question about it. The question is when and under which conditions.
Well, I know the problem for Hungary, and I imagine for several of the other countries as well, though, is that they are really reliant on the EU aid and on the trade agreements that they get for their economies, or, you know, they'd really be much worse off than they are now. So I know they hesitate to take such a drastic step as to actually leave the EU. So I don't know. It's a difficult problem, I know. But of course, if they continue on their present course, they might not exist in 50 years.
Of course. It's a question of to be or not to be, of survive or not survive. So, and by the way, of course, they are dependent on these, EU money. But on the other hand, look at our car industry. All our cars are, right now produced in these Eastern, nations. Jaguar Land Rover, for example, is building a huge plant in Slovakia, in Nitra. Audi is producing in Hungary, in Gier. Mercedes has built a big plant in Poland. Of course, Czech Republic with WV and Skoda and so on. So our cars, these Eastern Europe countries, they are already industrialized. We see the deindustrialization of Germany, but the car industry has long ago moved to the east. So there is, at least there is some industry.
Yeah, I hope that they'll eventually, like you said, be able to create a union for themselves, you know, only for the central and eastern countries. We'll have to see. But I have to say, I get a little bit worried in Hungary, like, you know, in late 2016, they had this referendum on accepting the EU's migrant quotas.
Mm-hmm.
And it did, I mean, the people who did vote, I mean, it was overwhelming. I think, you know, over 90% or something like that voted to reject the EU quotas. But, it says in Hungarian law that they at least 50% of eligible voters have to participate for a referendum to be valid. And they didn't even come close to that. And I think when I talk to most Hungarians, you know, they don't like the migrants, they don't want them here, but they also tend to be kind of apathetic and cynical when it comes to politics. And I worry that because of that, they won't develop the necessary will, you know, to address these things the way they really need to be taken on.
Mm.
I hope that will change, but right now it's a bit worrisome, I'd say. I mean, Hungary is still, of course, very conservative and very right-wing in many ways, but it's not, you know, I wouldn't say that they are willing to sort of isolate themselves from Europe in order to, you know, from Western Europe in order to, at least not at this stage. I hope it's not the same in Bulgaria.
The Bulgarian people are very connected to Russia. Well, whomever you ask, they are always grateful to the Russians, because Russia saved them. And, Bulgarian people are looking to more to the east than to the west.
How will that, impact the immigration issue?
Hard to say. I don't know.
Do you think that relationship could be the basis of kind of a resistance to the EU? Because then they could sort of look more to Russia for economic ties than to the West.
To be honest, I don't know. I really don't know. I Till now, I don't know. The people feel connected to Russia and to Russians, but also here, for example, the tourism, Russians don't come to Bulgaria right now because of the EU sanctions. Bulgaria is a member, of course. So also the Bulgarians experience this, sanctions in their relationship to the Russians. But I honestly cannot answer this question.
Well, we've been going for about an hour and a half now.
Oh my!
We could definitely have you on in a future podcast because, unfortunately, I don't think the immigration question is going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, maybe we can. This would be maybe some good idea because we are right now we are working on because till now Bulgaria is a paradise. You don't see headscarves, you don't see beards, and all this. It's not Islamized here. And we are working on a program, a resettlement program for Western Europeans. We try to found some communities here, Germans, but also people from Sweden, from Denmark. And we have a lot of interest here, people asking. And we want to offer a complete full service, all-inclusive package with logistics.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And business opportunities and so on.
Will Americans be eligible too?
Yes, of course.
Oh, that sounds great. I mean, Hungary, the same thing is happening in Hungary, although it's you know, I think it's more just people doing it on their own initiative. But you do see a lot more Western Europeans moving here for similar reasons.
Yeah, Viktor Orban actually openly made the call for that. He said that Hungary would be willing to accept refugees from Western Europe fleeing the situation, the unrestricted migration that's going on there.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's mainly just rhetoric because they want money from the Westerners. But still, it's good that he said that.
Yeah, of course. And he also has to invite young people. It doesn't help Hungary if only the pensioners are coming. And right now, I know a lot of pensioners who are buying properties and houses and everything in Hungary, but they don't reproduce themselves because also Hungary, as I know, has a demographic problem.
Yes. Yeah. Like all of the West, of course.
Yes. Yeah. Of course.
Most Americans, even on the right, really know very little about what's happening in Eastern Europe, especially not related to immigration, because it's never reported on.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
In the U.S. media. So I think people will find this very interesting. Also about what's happening in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to admit, I mainly only knew what the media was saying about it, so.
Yeah, or fake news media, yes. It's a ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly.
It is ridiculous what is going on. And this is the big difference between, for example, Germany and the U.S. I'm following U.S. media online as much as I can. And I'm always so thankful that there you still have at least some big media like Fox News and these people like, I don't know, Tucker Carlson and Ben Shapiro and all these intelligent people there. So you have, they have a voice. In Germany, there's no voice. Our state television is completely leftist. And so we are really trapped in Germany. There is no opposition, and whoever shows up on the opposition side is completely destroyed by criminal charges, financially ruined. So you don't have any chance anymore. It's a totalitarian state, and as you probably know, our Minister of Justice, he released a law about these Facebook blockings, everything. I'm right now. I'm blocked again. I'm almost blocked. I'm free to publish something for 1 week or 10 days, and then I'm blocked again. And it's ridiculous. So there's no freedom of speech anymore in Germany, and we really see totalitarian structures.
Are you safe from that, or can you be prosecuted yourself?
I am.
For,
I am. I have, as I said, sentence. Is the right word for it? The criminal charge. There's judgments against me. I have to pay huge amounts. And this is also something what I want. I have to do. I have to ask for donations because I think they charged me end of last year because of my speeches from 2015. So they grab in your past and they grab and they take. And because the restrictions were stricter and stricter from year to year. So right now they take things I said in my speeches in 2015. And now I got a criminal charge about this. So it's unbelievable what is going on. I really say goodbye to my own country. By the way, one of these criminal charges against me, New Year's Eve 2016-17, there was this big attack in Ceuta, which is on the Moroccan territory, but it's this exclave which belongs to Spain. And there was 1,100 Africans attacking this border fence, and highly aggressive, everything. And they were organized like it was in Hungary in 2015, in September. This was also an organized attack against this fence when Orban started to build the fence. I was there. I spoke with a military leader and also with the police leader were there. It was organized. They split up in several groups so that the border police had to split up as well. And then they managed to get into this in the Spanish onto Spanish territory. And of course, I made a Twitter and I said, shoot them. What else? Why is border police wearing a weapon? And if they are getting attacked, personally attacked, and they were hurt and they were violated and many of them have been in hospital, severely injured. So, of course, this is a natural thing. But in these times, the weapon is something you should never use. Even our German police is not using the weapon. They are beaten to the ground by two Afghans, 70-year-old, and the police has to go to the hospital, and the Afghans, they are laughing and shouting and pushing these pictures on Facebook, and now even more are encouraged to attack our police. So this is completely mad.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, something that should be common sense is protecting your borders, protecting your people.
Yeah.
You know, from invasion, from this, and especially this demographic threat, since they know that they're more fertile, that they're producing more children, and that's like their whole strategy.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that some people on the left might just be naive, but I think a lot of the ones in power, they really are malicious. They want to see the West brought to an end.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think they're more than happy with what's going on.
Of course.
During Trump's State of the Union, I noticed, you know, the Democrats, the ones who showed up, remained seated the whole time.
Yeah.
Even when he was saying that, you know, this plan he has for the illegals who are already in the U.S. would actually allow like three times as many as Obama did to stay.
Yeah.
And they still sat there like, oh, you know, like as long as there's a border, they'll be unhappy.
Yeah, of course. I was also watching. There were only very few. I think one Democrat, he was always standing up, applauding and so. But it was ridiculous. Yes, it was ridiculous.
Right. We're still a little bit better off in America than Western Europe, I think. But I don't, in another 20 years, I don't know. It's a question.
Yeah.
I mean, now if you're a Trump supporter, you're basically seen by half the U.S. as a Nazi.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
It's getting to be like the Salem witch trials, where there was this paranoia about young women being witches, but after a certain point it fell apart because everybody was being accused. Every young woman was being accused of being a witch, and with this whole Nazi, you know, when you have people who are the alt-light in America being called Nazis by the left, it loses all meaning.
Of course, this label loses its power, and this is because it's an inflation of even in Germany, and it is ridiculous to use this word against people who are not sharing your opinions. So, so it loses its power. Maybe this is one of the chances we see that all these terms and all these concepts are not working out anymore. So this is the reason why we see this escalation spiral. Of course, this is the reason why it's escalating now.
Yeah. Well, and even, I mean, people have been saying that Trump's positions on things like immigration, if it had been 30 years ago, nobody would have thought twice about it. It just seemed normal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And now it's regarded as extremist. I mean, it just shows you how rapidly things are changing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Trump has a big advantage, in my opinion. He is also emotional. And he is somehow a leader. And we are lacking these leadership personalities in the West. My opinion also, Marine Le Pen, for example, was much too weak and she compromised much too much. We don't see anybody in Germany. Of course, Orban is also somebody with this leadership qualities and this also profound speeches. I've never heard a good and intelligent and profound, more or less even philosophical speech from Merkel, for example. This is ridiculous, but this woman is telling to the crowd. But Orban, he has some really profound and higher thoughts in his speech. And of course, Trump, he is with this rude and funny talks and so on. So he is somebody people can connect with, can identify.
Right. Ordinary Americans, he's probably the first Republican in decades who ordinary Americans could relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because the two Bushes were really seen as part of the elite. And well, I guess maybe Reagan. I guess ordinary people liked Reagan.
Reagan, yes.
A long time ago.
I heard yesterday that Donald Trump Jr. said his father is a blue-collar billionaire. And this is, I think, it's a good description. He has this blue-collar approach and this very simple, normal approach, but he's also somebody who achieved a lot of success, so he is a good role model, maybe. He's a narcissist too, of course, but in my opinion, you can only fight narcissism with narcissists.
Yeah, I think you actually might be, like, a lot of the things that the left is accusing Trump of in the U.S. are all the things that they've been doing for years.
Yes.
So I don't really, it's kind of ridiculous to me.
Projection.
Of course, it's all just a strategy anyway.
It's projection.
Yeah, projection.
Of course, it's projection.
Well, Tatiana, thanks for joining us today, and we'll definitely have you on again in a future broadcast, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.